Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Christopher Leonard first visited Waldron, Arkansas in 2004 when he was covering national agribusiness for the Associated Press. Waldron looks like many rural towns that were once pillars of the American economy. Breakfast joint, local bank, and a weekly livestock auction populated by ranchers in cowboy hats. But Waldron's small-town economy is just window dressing. He writes that it would cease to exist if not for its true reason for being, Tyson Foods, the nation's biggest meat company. Tyson made a whopping $28 billion between 2010 and 2011, with $780 million in profits that year. Christopher Leonard's new book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business, profiles the rise of Tyson and other mega food companies that have quietly gained unprecedented control of America's meat market and reshaped the nation's rural economies. Christopher Leonard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Now, you write about America's meat business being an outright oligarchy in our nation's heartland. And your book's title, A Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. How did this business evolve under the radar?
Well, I think one key reason it evolved under the radar is that companies like Tyson Foods, which, as you mentioned, is sort of the main firm I profile in this book, but also other big companies like Cargill, Smithfield Foods, these companies are really anchored out in rural America in small towns that the national press just never visits, and in these communities that are really far away from the view of most consumers. That's where these firms really operate. And to understand Tyson Foods, it really helped to get out to these small towns where it's really the dominant economic force, as you just described. And that's where my inquiry into this company began, sort of looking at Tyson from the bottom up, if you will, in the small towns where it really operates the economy.
Well, people who do get out, granted you are a reporter, went to Waldron, but people didn't want to talk to you. What's at stake for them?
Well, their livelihoods are at stake, and that's exactly right. This was difficult to report because truly there is an atmosphere of fear and intimidation when you've got an economy that's so consolidated as it is in these small towns where Tyson operates. When I went down initially in 2004, I mean, people were afraid to talk to me about Tyson Foods in the safety of their own living rooms. And I spent a lot of time interviewing chicken farmers. And farmer is actually kind of a bad word to describe these people. They're more like industrial meat factory owners. They're people who would borrow maybe $2 million to build a large complex of industrial chicken houses and then sign a contract with Tyson Foods, which would deliver the birds to them to raise. And these farmers were so under the control of Tyson that they were afraid their neighbors would find out if they spoke to a reporter. I mean, the control this company had was shocking to me, and that's really what led me to start reporting on this book, was just the severe power structure I saw in Waldron and other towns. It really almost felt like a feudal system.
That's the way it reads, almost indebted servitude on the part of the farmers. We have the example of Yanita and Jerry Yandell, if I'm saying that properly, who lived steady middle-class lives with their three boys until batch after batch of chickens that they got from Tyson died. Now, what happened to these farmers?
Well, this is really where the book started for me. Tyson Foods has integrated every aspect of chicken production. In other words, on the north end of Waldron, Arkansas, just as in every other big poultry town, there's a giant industrial complex that Tyson owns, which has a slaughterhouse. There's a feed mill in complexes like this, a hatchery where the birds come from, a shipping, a trucking line, a railroad spur that brings in feed. And the farmers, like Jerry and Kenita Yandell, are sort of at the mercy of the quality of chicks that Tyson Foods will deliver to their farm to raise. And what really struck me about Jerry and Kenita Yandell was the fact that they had built a poultry farming business over decades. I mean, they'd been working in this business since they were teenagers. They'd borrowed money. They worked 7 days a week. And over about 30 years, they had built a solid middle-class living in Waldron, Arkansas. They lived in a brick house and owned a couple trucks, which was a sign of affluence in that community at the time. in just a matter of a few months, they were driven out of business. They were wiped out because there was some sort of problem at the hatchery that Tyson Foods operated. It wasn't Jerry and Kenita Yandell's operation. It was Tyson's. Tyson was delivering batches of birds to their farms, and the birds were just dying out en masse. I actually went down to that farm at this time, and Jerry and Kenita, or rather at that time, Jerry was out of town, and Kenita was telling me how she would just walk through the barns and pick up thousands and thousands of birds that were dying. And Tyson never fully explained to the Yandells what the problem was with these animals, but in the end it really didn't matter. They had to pay a huge mortgage payment on their farm, and because they lost so many birds, they couldn't make that payment on their mortgage, and they had to declare bankruptcy. They lost everything literally in a matter of months through no fault of their own.
And one of their neighbors also had trouble with his chickens. He wanted to get them tested, but he couldn't because the chickens didn't belong to him. They actually belonged to Tyson.
Yes, it was remarkable, and I think it really highlights the nature of the power relationship here. One of their neighbors, Doug Elmore, was really concerned because Tyson Foods was also delivering diseased animals to his farm, and he wanted to test the bird and find out what the problem was, understandably so. But again, Tyson Foods owns the birds the entire time. A chicken farmer never owns the most important asset on their farm, which is the bird. So if Doug Elmore had taken one of these chickens and sent it to the University of Arkansas, for example, to be independently tested for disease, Tyson Foods could have sued him for theft of one of its birds. So he had to surrender a diseased bird to a Tyson field technician who took it back to the company to test. And I guess not surprisingly, the test results were delivered back to him that said it was essentially his fault, that he hadn't been keeping his chicken houses clean enough and that the birds were suffering from ammonia poisoning.
Mm. Well, the chicken market has always been difficult. You write about its history defined by busts and booms pretty much until the 1960s, what you call the beginning of the chickenization of the American diet. Now, how can one company manage to make chicken the nation's most consumed meat? How can that be possible?
It's a pretty remarkable story. Back in the 60s, you know, at that time, it's kind of hard to think of now, but fast food restaurants did not really have much chicken on the menu. This was back before the chicken nugget, back before the chicken tender, back when the idea of eating a chicken sandwich, a chicken patty between two pieces of bread, was kind of an odd thing. Big chains served hamburger. But there was a brilliant entrepreneur in the South, Don Tyson, who realized that through this new system of producing chickens in a factory environment, an industrial system, he could make meat that was far cheaper than beef or pork. And he realized that the cheapness of this meat would make it all but irresistible to fast food chains like McDonald's and Burger King. Don Tyson worked for over a decade to convince McDonald's to put chicken on the menu. He was working their sales team relentlessly. Eventually, really through its own devices, you know, McDonald's decided, yeah, we can't ignore this. And Tyson Foods was one of the first companies to produce the McNugget. And it was so cheap and could be sort of pressed into so many different products, as I said, from like tenders to McNuggets, that soon it became America's most popular meat.
We're talking about the meat racket. That's the title of a new book by Christopher Leonard, and it's a thoroughly and thoughtfully investigated book and report about how our nation's meat production has been taken over by four major companies relatively quickly. Christopher, NPR's Dan Charles recently reported on this contract farming model, which is part of the vertical integration model that you talk about, initiated by Tyson Foods, now followed by just about everybody. Now, here he is in one of his reports introducing Tom Vukina. He's an economist at North Carolina State University. He studied the model and says from an economic point of view, it's brilliant. So here's Dan Charles and then Tom Vukina.
Vukina says contract farming solves problems like how do you make sure workers do a good job even when you can't watch what they do? How do you convince independent contractors to invest in new and better equipment? These are problems that economists have tried to solve with complex theories.
This thing has phenomenal, theoretically correct design features that they actually came up with knowing absolutely nothing about contract theory. It's actually remarkable. I think it's totally mind-boggling.
So there we have an economist praising this contract farming model, the result of which has created efficient production and pretty much cheap meat to Americans for decades, which he argues benefits society as a whole. So what, to your mind, doesn't work about this contract farming model?
Well, I'd like to address two points there, and I'll save one for later, which is the cheapness of chicken. But first of all, I interviewed the people that built this system initially. At Tyson Foods, for example, a gentleman named Joe Fred Starr, who was a close advisor of Don Tyson, another man named Jim Blair, who was senior attorney, general counsel at Tyson Foods, worked with Don Tyson for decades. And I think that economist does have something right in that this system was designed to control the farmer in a way that's difficult to do. I mean, Joe Fred Starr told me that back in the 60s, Tyson Foods realized you couldn't really hire somebody to do this job. It's a 7-day-a-week job. It's very tough. You have to be on point around the clock in case something goes wrong in the chicken houses. And these companies realized that if an independent farmer was heavily indebted, they had that motivation to stay on the farm 7 days a week and work on it. And the company made a strategic choice back in the 60s that they were not going to own these farms. Tyson initially experimented with owning the farms, realized it was kind of a crummy investment, and they'd rather leave that on the balance sheet of rural America, and found a group of farmers who were willing to enter contracts like this because, frankly, jobs in agriculture are fewer and more far between today than they were in the past when this company got started. But I really want to address this notion that the industry delivers these wonderful efficiencies to consumers. It's really, in the past, was true. When you look at the inflation-adjusted cost of meat over decades, you see something really interesting. The inflation-adjusted cost of meat fell steadily through the 70s and 80s as we industrialized the system. But, you know, in economics, everything has a cost. And the cost of this upfront savings for meat was that we traded away our competitive meat industry. And in the late 90s, you saw something really interesting start to happen. That cost curve flattened out. And then it started to rise. Today, meat prices are rising sharply. And that's not news to anybody who shops at the grocery store or anybody trying to feed a family on a budget. Meat prices are climbing very sharply. And that is due, in part, to the fact that we've lost competition in this business. History tells us time and again that when you let too few companies gain too much control over a market, they exercise that market power. It's pretty basic. And that's exactly what the meat companies are doing today, and they're keeping prices higher for consumers than prices otherwise would be.
I know for myself, my grocery bill has pretty much doubled since 2008, and I'm not feeding a big family. Is it really up to the consumer to change this system by rejecting these big-name foods?
It is totally unreasonable to expect that your average family is going to be able to buy all of their meat from the local farmers market. That's just not a realistic option for people. We've seen this happen repeatedly in the United States, that industries will become very consolidated. It happened 100 years ago. There's a wonderful book by Doris Kearns Goodwin called The Bully Pulpit that records an era like this in history 100 years ago. You know, industries will become highly consolidated. Monopolistic abuses will become widespread. And really what needs to happen is a public policy approach that will help reintroduce competition. I mean, competition is really at the root of capitalism. Transparent markets, open markets, competition that can allow new entrepreneurs to enter the field. That's the lifeblood of capitalism and free markets. That's what makes things work really well. And to do that, sometimes you need an outside hand to steer a market that has been taken over by just a few entities.
Christopher Leonard, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for the time.
Christopher Leonard is former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press and currently fellow with the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. And we do have much more on the book, including Tyson's written statement responding to Christopher Leonard's book, and also our full interview with Doris Kearns Goodwin about the bully pulpit, which Christopher mentioned today. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for a conversation with a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on the science behind the $1 trillion processed food industry. That's when Word of Mouth continues.